From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. George Soros is a billionaire on a mission. He grew up fleeing Nazis and communists in Eastern Europe, came to the United States in 1956, became a citizen, and made a vast fortune in global financial markets. For years, George Soros aimed his philanthropy at encouraging open societies abroad. Now he's turned his attention and his fortune to unseating George W. Bush. Soros has been both praised and criticized for the millions he has pumped into this year's presidential politics. He says he feels he has no choice, that George Bush's policies and perspective are putting the United States and the world in danger. Tonight on Point, billionaire George Soros and his campaign to push George Bush out of the White House. George Soros joins me in the studio. The famed hedge fund manager has written half a dozen books on global capitalism and democracy. The most recent Forbes 400 ranked him the 24th richest American with a net worth of $7.2 billion. His new book is The Bubble of American Supremacy, The Costs of Bush's War in Iraq. George Soros, welcome to On Point.
It's my pleasure.
So the bubble of American supremacy, we've seen financial bubbles. We know what they are. We had one recently. What's the bubble of American supremacy that you're describing?
I'm drawing an analogy with the financial bubble because bubbles don't grow out of thin air. There's a real foundation underneath, which is then misinterpreted in some ways. Let's say the Internet bubble. That was a real thing. The Internet is a very important development. But the way it was misinterpreted led to an unsustainable rise in the price of Internet stocks.
Now American power seems vast and unchallengeable. Are you saying American power itself is a bubble?
No. The reality is that we are the most successful. And militarily, also, we've been the most powerful nation on earth. But then came the misinterpretation by the Bush administration, which there was a group of people now referred to as neocons who believed that international relations are relations of power, not law, that international law merely ratifies what power has achieved. And since we are so all-powerful, we should have it our way. We should impose our supremacy and our views on the world. That was the idea with which they came into power. Then the 9/11 gave them the chance to put this belief into action and use the excuse of waging war on terror to execute their long-standing ambition of unseating Saddam Hussein from Iraq. And that's when we reached what I call far from equilibrium territory. That's when we went too far. It's unsustainable. It's counterproductive. And Iraq is the moment of truth where we discover that this approach is a false approach, that the world is not governed by military power, that, in fact, you can't impose your will by military power. Power is more like that children's game, you know, rock, scissor, paper. Mm-hmm. You know, military power is the rock, and let's say the insurgency in Iraq is the paper. Mm-hmm. And we cannot actually put down an insurgency by military means.
Far from equilibrium. When a financial wizard talks that way, it means something unsustainable. George Soros, you're a billionaire many times over. You've worked for open societies, human rights, democracy around the world. But now you are up to your hips in this American presidential election. You have to tell us how many millions you put in. I'm reading $18 million that you've put in one way or another into this election. You're on a several weeks tour of the country right now, talking everywhere. Yes. About your desire to see George Bush voted out of office. Why are you so deeply engaged in this election this year against this president?
Because this is not, in my view, a normal election. This is a referendum on Bush's first term, because he was elected on the basis of a humble foreign policy. Then came 9/11, the Bush doctrine of preemptive strikes, and the invasion of Iraq. If we now re-elect him, we are then endorsing those policies, and we have to live with the consequences. And as I try to explain in my book and in my message, the consequence is a vicious circle of escalating violence with no end in sight. Now, if we reject him, then we can say this was a temporary aberration brought on by the traumatic events of 9/11 and an administration that was exploiting our fears, and it's a temporary thing. We recognize it's wrong, and we change direction, and we elect another president who has a different idea and who will be able to bring our adventure to an orderly and honorable close.
You're incredibly critical of George Bush and the advisors around him, but here you're saying, in your view, the November 2nd election is not only a referendum on the Bush policies, but in a sense, Americans voting in a referendum on themselves, if they're going to continue supporting the Bush view or not. And if they do, if George Bush is reelected, how do you, George Soros, imagine the consequences?
Well, as I say, as you know, the rest of the world is really up in arms against us. If you travel anywhere in the world, the degree of condemnation of American policy has never been as great as it is today. If we reject Bush, then that can be attributed to his conduct, and we can resume our rightful place as a law-abiding, powerful nation. And regain the respect of the world. And that's what we need to accomplish.
And if that doesn't happen, if it goes the other way, the country is very closely divided. Many listeners tonight will be thinking, well, I'm voting for George Bush. In your view, George Soros, where does a Bush reelection take the country?
I think that we will find it impossible to extricate ourselves from Iraq. And we will be much less safe than we were before 9/11 because of our policies. You see, President Bush is telling the people that by taking the war on terror abroad, particularly to Iraq, has made us safer because we are fighting there instead of fighting here. That, I think, is one of the most atrocious ideas that I have ever heard, because it means that we are effectively hanging out our troops in Iraq as a flypaper to attract people to shoot at them. What a fate to expose our soldiers to.
But if it works, the country might say it's worth it. Do you think it will work? It is working?
Well, the evidence clearly shows that it isn't working, because the insurgency is gaining momentum, because the resentment. How would you feel as an Iraqi if you were being used as a territory to attract terrorists,
so that you
fight against terrorism there in order to make us safer? And people, every innocent life reinforces the cause of the terrorists who are fighting against us.
George Soros, I wonder how your childhood, growing up in Hungary during the Nazi period and then living under communism in Eastern Europe, affects your view or colors your view of the Bush administration and Bush policies today.
Very much so. It is based on those experiences that make me feel so strongly on this subject. And that's why I feel I have to speak out, because people haven't been through that experience. So for them, it's something new. I have seen how far off the rails you can go and how the kind of government that prevails can really determine whether you live or die.
But you've written that the Bush administration is nothing like the communism that Eastern Europe saw, the Nazism that Germany brought in those days. It's nothing like that, and yet you're warning about going off the rails. So what exactly is the fear, the warning here?
Of course, it would be very different, because I can speak. If I did that in the Soviet regime, I wouldn't be dead. So this is we are a democracy, and we have elections, and we can approve or disapprove of the policies of our government. And we must use that opportunity to disapprove of the policies which, in my opinion, have endangered us. And let me be specific, mm-hmm. because we now know that there were no weapons of mass destruction, and there was no connection with the terrorists who attacked us. What hasn't yet sunk in to the people, that actually President Bush and his advisors, Vice President Cheney and Condoleezza Rice, they actually knew at the time that there were no weapons of mass destruction. A recent article in the New York Times has documented how the intelligence experts of the Energy Department have advised the White House in 2002 that those famous aluminum tubes mm-hmm. couldn't possibly be used for centrifuges making nuclear weapons. So when they were, yet they used that evidence as the key evidence for telling us that there is a danger of weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. So they deliberately deceived us. This idea that they deliberately deceived us has not yet entered into the consciousness of the public.
You write in the book, The Bubble of American Supremacy, you say, the government of the most powerful country on earth has fallen into the hands of extremists who are guided by a crude form of social Darwinism. You describe the Bush administration as sort of waiting for a reason, an excuse, an opportunity to push this agenda. But what is this social Darwinist agenda that you perceive here, George Soros?
This is what I said earlier, that international relations are relations of power, and it's the most powerful that prevails. And it's as I call it, primitive, because they define a power in terms of military power, in terms of competition, whereas what makes people species successful is cooperation, not only competition. And the idea of cooperation is left out. So this is a false concept of what power is. This is what I was saying earlier.
And do you see any pull back from that social Darwinist view as the operations in Iraq have been so difficult? Do you see the Bush administration learning in real time, perhaps adjusting toward the George Soros view?
No, unfortunately, this is the great shortcoming of President Bush, that he cannot admit any mistakes, whereas the idea of an open society is based on the recognition that we may be wrong. And we must allow for that. And he simply is incapable of doing that. And that's why we have to change him, remove him from power.
You know, there are people who say, and we'll talk more about this, but that one billionaire shouldn't have as big a megaphone as your millions have bought, can buy. Do you feel any second thoughts about applying your enormous wealth to democratic presidential process?
Look, I am heard. I do have a platform. Part of the reason why I have a platform is because the Republican propaganda machine has demonized me. So every Republican has heard my name as some kind of Satan. So here I am. I'm standing up, and I'm explaining why I'm taking the stance that I'm taking. I'm willing to answer questions that I receive on my website, georgesoros.com, and I want to engage in a reasoned dialogue. And this is what an election is all about.
Bruce Springsteen is on tour until Election Day. George Soros is nearly doing the same. Coast to coast, he's got a new book, The Bubble of American Supremacy. His big two-page ad in the Wall Street Journal across the country last week, headline, Why We Must Not Reelect President Bush. This is a billionaire on a mission. We spoke with George Soros earlier today, so it's on tape. We can't take your calls, and I'm sorry for that, but we're glad to have him to get insights on what he's up to. We'll be right back with more on how much money, on exactly what the goals are of the George Soros push. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with billionaire philanthropist, now billionaire political mover and shaker, George Soros. He's dumping millions into this year's presidential campaign. He makes no bones about his goal. He wants to see George W. Bush unseated, a man who grew up in Eastern Europe under the Nazi time first, under communists, made it to the United States after a stint at London School of Economics, became a billionaire many times over with his very successful work in the financial markets around the world, always often admired for that, sometimes feared for the sway that he's wielded in that world. Now the same in the political world. George Soros, can you tell us exactly, I'm reading here that you've put or will put $18 million into this political season. Is that true? And is there a point at which, no matter how good and correct you think your views are, is there a point at which one billionaire is putting too much money into a system?
The figure actually is now $20 million. Plus $3 million that I'm spending on this tour, which is in a way serving the same purpose. If you put that in the context of the billion that he's going to spend on the elections, it's not very much. But of course, as an amount, it is remarkable. It's not very much in context of the $450 million I spend on the foundations worldwide either.
This has been annually for some time now, promoting democracy and open societies, as you call them.
Yes. So it's from that perspective, it's really not but it is still a very large amount of money. But if you look at the two sides, when I came into the picture, the Republicans had more than double the amount of money available than the opposition. I then investigated how could I legally help to redress the balance. My advisors pointed me to these organizations called 527s.
520, MoveOn.org, yes. America Coming Together, and so on, outside the official campaign spending controls.
That's right. And as long as they are not coordinated with the campaign, they are legal. And I'm definitely not coordinated with the campaign.
Let me ask you, you say you spend $450 billion around the world on philanthropy. You're putting, let's say, 20, 22, 23 million into this campaign season in the United States. But is there amount that would be too much? What if you put $450 million into this campaign? Would you consider that outside? Is there a number at which even George Soros would say, well, I'm rich, but that's too much for one man to put into a campaign?
Well, when the original proposal was put to me that it would be useful to have a grassroots organization that would mobilize the votes, and that would cost $75 million. I didn't put up $75 million. I put up $10 million in the hope of attracting others to put money in. So I don't think that just money by itself can possibly do it.
But what if next time around, in the next election, I mean, you're fabulously wealthy, but you're only the 24th wealthiest American. What if some other very wealthy American comes in on the other side, putting $100 million, $200, $500 into a Republican campaign or related support? Do you fear that?
In actual fact, there has been a group of wealthy Republicans who have been putting large amounts of money, more than $200 million a year, into Republican causes. That has been going on for the last two decades, and that has been the foundation on which, let's say, this right-wing movement has been built up. So I am coming in rather late. I resisted getting involved in domestic politics. It was proposed to me that I should have set up some kind of a counterweight to these right-wing initiatives, and I absolutely refused it because they have an agenda, they have an ideology, whereas I believe in an open society where different people have different views and they have to engage in rational, reasonable discussions out of which the truth emerges. So I don't have an ideology, and if you if I did the same thing on, as they do, then I would be contributing to undermining the institutions that have made this country great.
You say you don't have an ideology, but ever since you studied at the London School of Economics under Karl Popper, you've been very interested in open societies. Of course, he wrote about open society and its enemies. You express concern now that the United States itself could pose a threat to open societies around the world. What do you mean by that?
Well, open society is basically a broader definition of democracy. It's based on the recognition that nobody is in possession of the ultimate truth, that we operate on the basis of imperfect understanding. We may be wrong, and therefore we need institutions and public discussion that allow the truth, something approaching the truth, to emerge. That's the basis of an open society.
So you're not buying the sort of end of history argument, Francis Fukuyama and others, saying that after the Cold War we've come to this place where there's a single sustainable model for success, and the United States is basically the preeminent example of that? You're not buying that, George Soros?
No, I'm not buying that, and that's where I part company with the neocons, because they confuse freedom with American dominance. When President Bush says freedom will prevail, what he really means is America will prevail. I really believe in freedom, and that means that different people have different ideas of how their society should be organized. And open society values are not necessarily American values. We, America, have been an open society, but it's not the only form of open society that can exist. So that's where we have made a serious mistake.
But you know, George Bush says we are specifically and directly threatened as an open society by these closed Islamist movements that would like to shut such societies down. He seems just as driven in the opposite direction from you, George Soros, to say we must bring this freedom, whatever it suggests, we must bring it to the rest of the world. Otherwise, our very open society will be under perpetual threat.
Yes, it is, in fact, that is true. And there's no doubt that the terrorists are eager to destroy our open society. But we must be different from them. The communists wanted to destroy capitalism, but we should not employ the same methods as they do. In other words, you don't fight terrorism by state terrorism, for instance. So you have to defend yourself against terrorism. You have to defend your freedoms, but you mustn't succumb to fear and act as your enemies want you to do. Basically, in my opinion, Bin Laden wanted us to respond the way we did to the terrorist attack, and particularly by going into Iraq, we have given an unintended gift to Bin Laden, because he could recruit now much better than he could before. One of the main points I'm trying to get across is that we are much less secure than we were before September 11.
And you write about what you call a supremacist ideology that you also trace back to the neocon camp, and two classes of sovereignty that you believe the Bush administration has an idea that they've embraced. What do you mean by two classes of sovereignty?
Well, the Bush doctrine has two pillars. One is that we must maintain our unquestioned military supremacy in any part of the world. And second, we have the right to take preemptive action against anybody who we consider to be a threat. Now, each of these pillars, taken on its own, is very justified and desirable. But if you put it together, it means that there are basically two classes of countries, us, who have absolute superiority and can impose our will on the rest of the world, and the rest of the world that has to be subject to the Bush doctrine. Now, one way to escape from this doctrine is to have nuclear weapons. If you have nuclear weapons,
and you're opposing the United States,
and then the United States can't impose its will on you.
Mm-hmm.
So North Korea is now free. Pakistan is free. Iran wants to be free. Okay, so there is we have now put into practice an incentive for people to acquire nuclear weapons, and that is the greatest danger to our future security. Now, the remarkable thing is that we didn't attack Iran, we didn't attack North Korea, of course we didn't attack Pakistan. We attacked Iraq because we knew that they didn't have nuclear weapons. In other words, that was the and actually Paul Wolfowitz admitted it, because he said we must go into Iraq because it's doable. So we wanted to demonstrate to the world how powerful we are, and we picked on a country that didn't have nuclear weapons in order to demonstrate it.
George Soros, you fled Hungary in 1947. Made it to the United States, I think, in 1956, became a citizen in 1961, had an incredible ride and continue to in the financial markets, made $1 billion in one day in 1992 when you famously broke the British pound. But now when you look at the home of your emigration, the United States, you say this is not the America I chose as my home.
That's right.
This pulls it back domestically. It pulls it back inside the borders. What about the United States, in your view, is not what you chose as your home today?
Well, under the Bush administration, it isn't. If we reject this, then we have asserted our democratic rights. We have rejected this aberration, and we will be back on track. So we have gone off the rails. It's not the first time that has happened. We have had episodes before, you know, the McCarthy era, imprisonment of the Japanese during Japanese Americans during the Second World War, and so on. So since an open society is always an imperfect society, we are entitled to go off the rail from time to time, as long as we get back on it. And this is our opportunity now to reject the Bush administration and get back on the rail.
Is the sign, the fact that you are out on the, practically on the hustings now yourself, freely expressing your opinion about this, is it a sign of democratic health at home in the United States?
Partly, that's what it is, but partly it's my fear that maybe we will not pass the test this time. You know, when, let's say, you had Watergate, we then impeached the president. We passed the test. We upheld the principles of an open society. Maybe this time we will fail, and I'm worried about it, and that's why I'm speaking out as I am.
Republicans have responded very strongly to your role here. All kinds of questions raised. Dennis Hastert, a Speaker of the House, even suggesting something about, you know, George Soros. Who knows where he made his money? Maybe he made his money in drugs. Of course, the financial world knows where you made your money, but the attack has been virulent. What do you make of it?
Well, that's a particular segment. That's the Bush propaganda machine. Actually, the moderate Republicans, the traditional Republicans, are very disturbed about these developments, and I've been trying to reach them because there is this latent unrest about the excesses of the Bush administration. So I would not equate that with the Republicans. I think that there is not that much difference between moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats. That's what is the core of the nation. And it's just that a rather extremist minority captured one of the main parties and dragged the discussion very far in one direction, so, and we have to bring it back again.
So when you talk, I don't know, in the boardrooms or on Wall Street to other big money individuals, of course, many of them are backing George Bush. What do they say to you? What kind of response do you get? Are you persuading them?
I got a very good response to my ad in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, you know, my peers, friends who were worried about my sort of being too far out. They called me and said, finally, you have
gone over the line, George. Or no, you've said it publicly.
No, when the Wall Street Journal...
It's the big two-page ad.
They said, now you've laid out a case, mm-hmm. and I'm glad you did. And I've found it very persuasive. I asked one of my friends, what was it that was persuasive to you? What new did you get out of it? He said, interestingly, that the Bush administration had so many flip-flops and missteps in Iraq. I didn't realize that before. So my hope is that people will just take the trouble to read, it takes 15 minutes, and give it some thought. And if they disagree, I'd love to hear from them and argue with them on my website, georgesoros.com.
Of course. We've just got a minute left here, but I can't help but wonder, you were a young immigrant. Now, decades later, you're taking on the president of the United States. Do you ever feel like, oh, my gosh, what am I doing here? I'm going too far. Or do you feel that this is your duty, your obligation?
Well, you know, it is I am sticking my neck out. There's no doubt about it. And the reason I'm doing it is because I do have a platform. You know, I have done a lot for promoting open society. I have name recognition. The Bush machine has done a lot to make my name known. And I want to use that opportunity to get my views at least heard and have people consider it and accept it or reject it.
And in the hope that this will become the country that you you knew, that you aimed to emigrate to, that you did emigrate to years ago.
And it still is, after all. I mean, we do have still free discussion. Here I am talking to you. So this is the country that I love, I believe in, and I want to keep it an open society.
George Soros, the new book is The Bubble of American Supremacy. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, Ambassador Dennis Ross on peace and the Middle East. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. When Yasser Arafat rejected Israel's long-negotiated peace proposal at Camp David in the year 2000, Ambassador Dennis Ross was right in the middle of the meltdown. As Mideast envoy and chief negotiator from 1988 to 2000 for Bill Clinton and for the first President Bush, Dennis Ross has seen as much as anyone of what works and what doesn't in the search for Mideast peace. With 32 dead last week, including many Israelis in the bombing of the Taba Hilton, and more than 100 Palestinians killed by Israeli troops in Gaza since September 30th, a settlement seems far away. And now, Iraq is at war as well. Dennis Ross is now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's out with a new book entitled The Missing Peace, The Inside Story of the Fight for Middle East Peace. We invited him to talk about the region, the impact of the Iraq War, and the road ahead now. Dennis Ross, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We're going to talk a lot tonight about this close tick-tock you've given us of the negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. But I'd like to start pulling the lens back, if we could, and then go narrower.
Sure.
On the whole Middle East, and with your intimate involvement in the effort to bring peace between Israelis and Palestinians, how you see what's going on now regionally? Are we moving closer to peace or some kind of new day in the Middle East, or are we moving into chaos?
Unfortunately, today I would say that the trend is more towards chaos than moving towards peace. It doesn't mean that it's impossible to get to peace. It doesn't mean that there aren't some hopeful trends. But for the most part, what we're dealing with right now is a war in Iraq and a war between Israelis and Palestinians. And the combination of two wars does not create an environment that gives one a lot of hope right now. That said, I think there is a way to move from war in a more favorable direction, and there are some interesting signs in terms of reformers throughout the Middle East being much more prepared to be assertive, much more prepared to push a reform agenda than was ever the case before. So if we were to get active again, involved again between Israelis and Palestinians to try to become a bridge between them again as we were in the past, I have some hope there. Iraq, I think, is a much more difficult proposition. But moving to try to stop the war between Israelis and Palestinians, embarking on an approach in Iraq that is really geared towards having Iraqis own the problem, creating a different political dynamic in Iraq, which we can talk about, and recognizing that the reformers are those that we should be identifying in the region, all of these could end up moving us in a more favorable direction, but it's not going to be easy.
In the last few days, 10 days, we've seen U.S. fighter jet bombing Sadr City, bombing this slum of Baghdad. It can't help but bring to mind, I'm sure it did for you, the scenes we've seen of American-made planes with Israeli pilots, occasionally in the conflict between those two sides, bombing in the West Bank. Is the United States stepping into an Israel-style role in Iraq, or is that not a useful analogy?
I think there is a difference here because we do have now an interim government in Iraq that is our partner. We have to think about how do we make it more credible, not how do we make it less credible. We have to think about how do we create a new dynamic there. Now, that's a parallel, I think, for the Israelis and the Palestinians. There isn't right now an Israeli partner on the Palestinian side that they see who is their partner. Doesn't mean that there might not be. Palestinian reformers could be. But here again, the question is, how do you empower them? How do you make them more likely to succeed? The same thing applies within Iraq. But I see a difference. The fundamental difference is that in Iraq, you have insurgents who are fighting us and who have made themselves more credible by making themselves a symbol of resistance to us. And you have those Iraqis who want to create a new day. And the question is, how do you create circumstances for them where they're more likely to succeed? One of the problems I think that we face is that in August we had an event that had been highly touted, the National Conference. It brought together over 1,000 Iraqis from all over the country.
Under super high security because things were popping all over the place.
Exactly. There was some boycotting of it, but less than had been originally anticipated. And it was hijacked by what went on in Najaf. Rather than building its focal point around the whole concept of elections, the timetable for elections, and the Iraqi ownership of that process, the focal point became
U.S. troops, Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army in the mess in Najaf at that time.
And who's going to protect the Imam Ali shrine? That's the last thing you wanted the National Conference to be doing. It was supposed to create a new dynamic. It was supposed to create a political process that was clearly Iraqi and not shaped by us. Now, I would actually suggest one of the things we need to get back to is maybe holding a second such conference as a way of changing the internal dynamic.
I'm going to ask you a very political question. You worked for George H.W. Bush. You worked for Bill Clinton. Does it make a difference who's elected on November 2nd in terms of how soon Iraq can be solved? Who do you prefer to see as commander-in-chief for the next 4 years in terms of the Iraq problem, Dennis Ross?
Well, I'll answer it analytically.
Oh, please.
I know that surprises you. The critical question is, do you recognize the problem you're in? The first sign of wisdom is recognizing the situation and then developing a strategy accordingly. If the administration believes everything it's saying, then I would be concerned that they don't fully appreciate what they're in. On the other hand, if there's a greater appreciation under the surface, and certainly I think the readiness to begin to try to clear out the Sunni Triangle area suggests some greater understanding. The acceleration of training of Iraqi forces represents another part of understanding. The lack of understanding about, I think, the full political dynamic and what's going on is a worrisome sign to me. I think on Senator Kerry's side, he certainly seems to appreciate that we're in a mess. And the question is going to be, does he fully appreciate how to move us out of it? I think when it comes to the Europeans, we should not have high expectations that the Germans or the French are going to be sending troops into Iraq to help us out. So the real question relates to, again, the political dynamic. I would actually do something that runs against everyone's grain. I would actually try to organize with the Iraqis a new national conference, make it clear that its focus is on how to ensure that the political process as it relates to elections unfolds in a way that serves Iraqi interests. And I would actually accelerate elections.
Drive more quickly to
yes.
more democracy.
Yes. I mean, the concern that you're going to be excluding the Sunni areas and they'll feel therefore disaffected, they already feel disaffected.
But this next step in democracy is supposed to be drawing up a constitution. If the Sunnis feel left out of that, won't they feel perpetually left out?
Well, I think the critical question is you hold the elections wherever you can as a way of demonstrating that the Iraqi people want to hold elections. Every poll demonstrates that and has for the last almost year and a half, by the way. And it shows it's not just the Shia because it's 90% basically want to see elections. Now, if you can hold elections and you say we'll hold them wherever we can and we'll hold them as soon as we can, as soon as the security conditions permit, then what you're doing is you're creating a new context. And the context is the Iraqis want to hold elections. It's the insurgents who are blocking them. Right now, the insurgents gain credibility by looking like they're the symbol of opposition to us. Mm-hmm. We need to make it clear that they're the symbol of opposition to the Iraqi people.
Let's begin to turn to Israel, but to turn in this way first. There were those who presented the war in Iraq, among many other angles on it, that it would make Israel safer, that it would remove the threat of Saddam Hussein's armies, of Saddam Hussein's regional ambitions, his support of suicide bombers in the Palestinian side. Now we see, okay, there's a mess in Iraq, and Iran coming on with a nuclear, what may well be a nuclear weapons development program. Is Israel better off or not for the war in Iraq?
Let me answer it in two ways. First, there were also those who said that the road to Jerusalem ran through Baghdad.
Yes.
That was always an illusion.
This is the kind of neocon view.
Yes, it was always an illusion. And to some extent, it obviously embodied the administration's approach as well.
That is, you've got to deal with Baghdad first before you can have peace between the Israelis
and
Palestinians.
Right, and it'll make it more likely. It'll make it easier. But let's be clear. We have the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a conflict between two national movements competing for the same space. That existed before Saddam Hussein was around, and it obviously exists even after he has been deposed. So it was an illusion to think that. It doesn't bear much relationship to it. Could it have created, had it succeeded the way the administration hoped it would succeed? Could it have created a different context? Could it have created a different climate? Could it have made the notion of intractable problems more tractable? Yes, but that's contextual. That's environmental. It wasn't going to deal with the core issues, number one. Number two, is Israel safer today? If you ask the Israelis, of course they'll say they're better off with Saddam Hussein gone. But by the same token, if you ask the Israelis, they would have always told you the real threat to them wasn't Saddam Hussein, it was Iran. It was mullahs with nukes. And the fact of the matter is, Iran is much closer to having nuclear weapons today than they were a couple years ago, and much closer, as it turns out, than Saddam Hussein ever was. So I would say, from the standpoint of the Israelis, they're not safer today because the real existential threat they face from Iran is much more pronounced than it was. And if you look at the Iranians today, the Iranians feel because we're consumed in Iraq, there's very little we can do to them because it's basically been the British, the French, and the Germans who've dealt with them. They're acting quite confidently because they feel they have more leverage on the Europeans than the other way around.
So if you look at Iraq in its relation to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and then that conflict itself, what kind of grade do you give the Bush administration at this point? President Bush said, we don't have a partner for peace in Yasser Arafat.
Yeah.
We're going to slow down on that front, laid out a roadmap for peace that essentially seems essentially forgotten now and went to war with Iraq. What's your overall grade, Ambassador Ross?
Well, I give them lower grades on this. I mean, but I give them lower grades because their focus was frankly not on diplomacy. They disengaged from diplomacy. You know, the reality is that the Bush administration looked at what we did in the Clinton administration and felt it was too hard, too much. We were committed in a way that distorted our interest in the Middle East. They said when we come in, we're going to have a regional focus. And what they meant by that is we're going to focus on other issues. We're going to focus on regime change with regard to those regimes that are a real threat and less on this. And you could say that given how much we were involved, and the book is the embodiment, and in a sense I'm the embodiment of the involvement.
Yes.
You could say we failed. We didn't make peace, and that's a fact. But you know what we did? We prevented a war.
And you're talking during the Clinton years.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And we made it possible to engage in peace, to create the possibility of peace. But the fact is one of the things that we did by doing what we did is ensure that you wouldn't see what you're seeing today between Israelis and Palestinians. Since 2001, there's been no peace process. There's been only a war. And the price paid by both sides has been terrible in terms of the human toll. But in addition to that, there's been a psychological cost, a very high psychological cost. You know, some of the younger members of the Fatah activists that I know quite well now,
Arafat's group.
Right, but they're the driving force for reform now. They're challenging him in unprecedented ways because they know that he offers chaos and not salvation. You ask them why it's so important to get back to peacemaking, why it's so important, why they believe in a two-state solution, not a one-state solution, and they'll tell you what's happened in the last 3.5 years is that the next generation of Palestinians have been socialized only by this situation, only by war, and the consequence is their model is Al-Qaeda.
All gun, all bomb.
That's right. No faith in peacemaking. Both sides have lost that. And that's the consequence, in my judgment, of having a war where you didn't employ diplomacy. The measure of diplomacy is not always what you achieve. It's also what you prevent or limit or contain.
Which puts part of it at the Bush administration's doorstep.
Exactly. If the Bush administration disengaged in a diplomatic sense, and I believe that was a basic mistake.
Dennis Ross, Ariel Sharon, of course, says he wants to pull out of Gaza. Last week, a very high aide to Sharon, Dov Weissglass, said that this will be the freezing of the peace process, that the Gaza withdrawal will provide the formaldehyde, his word, necessary so that there is no political process with the Palestinians. You freeze the process, you prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state, he said to Haaretz, the newspaper in Israel. What do you make of this?
Well, I read the whole interview. Not the first cut that they did were sort of the highlights, but when you read the context, it's a little bit different. What he says is, look, we will have taken this step. Now, if Palestinians do nothing, then you'll have a frozen process, and there won't be a Palestinian state. If they do something, then you're going to have a political process. Now, that actually, I would say, is almost a statement of reality. His use of the terminology formaldehyde creates a kind of sensational cast to it. But the reality here is we've had a situation completely frozen in the last 3.5 years. You mentioned the roadmap. Mm. I'm always asked about the roadmap, and I'm asked, is it dead? And I said, how can it be dead when it was never born? Mm. You know, we never engaged in it the way we would have if we were serious about producing it. We didn't negotiate it with either the Israelis or the Palestinians, who had to carry out all of its obligations. We never offered our own definition of what would constitute performance of those obligations. Mm. So it was presented as a piece of paper. Now, as a piece of paper, it's still there. It could be a set of guidelines. But the reality is you've had a frozen situation in terms of hopes. You've had a deteriorating situation in terms of reality on the ground. You have a war. The situation's frozen. Ariel Sharon's decision to pull out of Gaza actually creates the potential to unfreeze the situation if you can build on it, if you can have the Israeli steps where they actually dismantle settlements and you have the Palestinians assuming responsibilities on the ground.
We've got half a minute left. How deeply involved in that this time should Washington be?
We have to be extremely involved in that. That's one of the lessons of the book is you may not need us at the point when they're prepared themselves to make the big decisions, but we're not there. They don't even talk to each other now. We need to be a bridge between the two. If we don't do it, instead of having an opening, we're going to have an opening that closes. And the one thing we know about Middle Eastern openings, when they close, you're always worse off.
Dennis Ross, you tell a fascinating story in the new book, The Missing Piece, the inside story of the fight for Middle East peace. And it's always terrific talking with you. Thanks so much for coming in. Good to see you.
A real pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.